You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
Checking in San Francisco, and this is Bloomberg Technology. Coming up in the next hour, President Biden in Poland at the center of Ukraine's refugee crisis as Russia's military focuses on taking full control of the Donbass region but falters in Kyiv. We'll look at the continuing fallout from the war from cyberspace to outer space. Plus, Apple doling out an additional unusual bonus to key engineers, some upwards of $200,000. How to keep staff loyal as the post-pandemic war for talent ramps up. We'll have more on that Bloomberg scoop. And Instacart also trying to lure new employees by taking an unexpectedly lower valuation, slashing its own valuation by almost 40%, from $39 to $24 billion. This is public market volatility. Continues. We'll discuss another Bloomberg scoop. All of that in a moment, but first, let's get a look at the markets. Tech stocks ending the week down. Our Ed Ludlow here now with the latest. And it's not all bad news, right?
No,
Ed?
No. Okay, look, we're a little lower, flat on a Friday, but we did see a late comeback from the NASDAQ 100. Very tech-heavy index, of course. That's as oil trim games. You see WTI, West Texas Intermediate above $110 a barrel, higher. Well, $113 a barrel, and the U.S. 10-year yield at 2.47%, near 2.5%. But coming into my Bloomberg terminal, look, we have some sustained momentum in tech stocks. The NASDAQ 100 having its first back-to-back weekly gain since the beginning of February. That despite the backdrop of higher yields, of course. Higher yields has impacted tech stocks with higher multiples. There's concern, of course, that it discounts the present value of future profits. Elsewhere, big tech names on the move, of course. This Friday, looking at Meta, parent company of Facebook, it looks like the US and EU has reached a deal, an accord over data movement, the flow of data between the two continents. Facebook was a company that expressed concern there. Okta continues to be lower after that hike, and Spotify ending its ad-backed platform, free-to-play platform in Russia as well, Emily.
All right, Ed, thanks for that update. I want to move now to our top story. Talks between Russia and Ukraine are making no progress, according to a top aide to the Ukrainian president. But President Biden did make progress with EU leaders on a plan to wean Europe off Russian oil and tighten sanctions. The president also visiting troops near Poland's Ukrainian border as the war enters its second month. Joining us now, Bloomberg's Aggie Cantrell from the ground in Poland. Aggie, you have been near the Polish border since almost the beginning of the war. Talk to us about how the refugee crisis you're seeing is evolving.
Yes, so when I first came here several weeks ago now, the waiting times for people to try and cross the border was up to 60 hours, which in a Polish and Ukrainian winter can be a real risk to people's lives. And that was a real concern for the border guards and for the authorities on both sides of the border. Now we're seeing that that process of getting people over the border has been streamlined, and it's also coupled with the fact that there are actually fewer people crossing the border now than were a couple of weeks ago. When I speak to volunteers on the ground here, a lot of them think that quite a lot of the people who've already crossed the border are those who are already going to do so, and then the ones who remain in Ukraine are choosing to do so to be closer to their families.
Now, President Biden's visit to the Polish border, is any of this changing how he feels, how the U.S. will respond to Russia?
Well, to be honest, there is an immediate effect of Biden's visit in the fact that the day before he arrived here in Rzeszów in Poland, the White House announced that the USA would be taking in 100,000 of the Ukrainian refugees. Of course, that pales in comparison to the 2 million that Poland has taken in. However, that is a significant step on the part of the United States. And him coming here is also a signal to Poland that they're acknowledging the humanitarian relief that Poland is doing here. And also, Poland has been pushing for the EU to give them greater aid when it comes to financially supporting them throughout this refugee crisis.
What's next for the president? Where is he off to?
He's heading to Warsaw after this, so he's going to meet with more people in Warsaw. Today, he already met with the 82nd Airborne here in Rzeszów, and now he's going on to Warsaw, the capital of Poland, in order to have further meetings. And so a key factor of these meetings that he's having here in Poland is not just the humanitarian angle, but also the security angle. President Duda, the Polish president, said in his press conference today with President Biden that he saw that his country was essentially the front line of the current concerns that the NATO alliance have when it comes to Russia's aggression against Ukraine.
All right, Bloomberg's Aggie Cantrell for us with an update from Poland. Thank you, Aggie, for your reporting there from the ground. Meantime, cybersecurity defenses around the globe remain boosted as the war on Ukraine persists. Joining us now, Tony Anscombe, Chief Cyber Threat Officer of ESET, the group that detected the latest round of cyber attacks targeting various Ukrainian organizations. And talk to us about this latest salvo, Tony. What is significant about the tactics you're seeing from the Russians?
Well, firstly, these cyber attacks were data wipers. So, I mean, we're all very familiar with things like ransomware that encrypts data and you can get it back if you pay the cyber criminal. These are just malicious pieces of code that actually do exactly what they say on the tin. They wipe the data so it can no longer be accessed or recovered in any way. So it's very, very malicious. And what is interesting about these particular variants is there was intent here because they were compiled, some of them back in the end of last year. And they've been sitting on systems, and we think they've been there for some time prior to actually being implemented. We don't know how they got there, but we certainly know they've been there for some time and then unleashed to coincide with Russia's attack on the Ukraine. Now, you know, we can't attribute where these came from or who wrote these pieces of code. But yes, they're causing damage.
You've detected a couple of other attacks in recent weeks, but there is this lingering question of why we're not seeing more and more devastating cyber attacks from Russia. Why is that?
Well, I have my own opinion here, Emily. It could well be that you know, firstly, it's very hard to attribute a cyber attack if somebody launches a cyber attack, actually turning around and saying it came from this person or this group is very difficult and complex. So if all nation states have the ability to have a cyber attack on each other, it could actually be that we're sitting here looking at the new digital deterrent in the same way we think of a nuclear deterrent. Everybody has one and it's hopefully stops everybody using it. Maybe that's the case where we're sitting with a digital deterrent, that each side knows that they both have access to tools that could do untold damage in societies all over the world. And maybe we're seeing that play out now.
How strong do you think cyber defenses are? Of course, we've been hearing these warnings from the Biden administration that companies need to buckle up, boost all of their defenses. Is it going to work?
Well, hopefully. I mean, let's be clear. Over the last several years, we've seen so many cyber attacks and so much infrastructure and finance and education, you know, get attacked by ransomware, all for monetization purposes. So a lot of organizations are already very well down the path of having the right pieces in place to keep themselves protected. This is just another bump on for cybersecurity teams to turn and say, right, we need to do a little bit more. But I think this is not, we're not starting from scratch here, and that's my point. One thing that concerns me, though, is if you look at the number of, for example, water utility companies here in the US, there's 50,000 of them, and many of them are very, very small and very regional. And I think they probably lack a lot of the skills and resources needed to actually create that cyber secure environment. I'm not far from you down in Half Moon Bay, and I'm certainly the one here in Half Moon Bay is very small and very rural.
All right, well, let's hope that all of these companies, all of these different organizations, these utilities have what they need when it comes to protecting themselves. Tony Anscombe of ESET, thank you for giving us an update on cyberspace. Coming up, grocery delivery giant Instacart slashing its valuation by almost 40%, but saying it's a good thing for employees at least. We'll discuss why next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop. Customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Apple is paying a small number of engineers another round of special stock bonuses. This is part of an unusual push to retain key talent, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Let's bring in Bloomberg's Mark Gurman on yet another scoop. So, Mark, look, Apple pays out bonuses all the time, but this one seems more unusual. Why are they doing this?
Yeah, so this is a bonus. This is the second time they're doing this. This is restricted stock units, so these vest over 4 years. Right now, obviously, inflation's very high. Bay Area high housing prices are increasing per usual. You're seeing a lot of poaching being done from Amazon, Microsoft, and particularly Meta / Facebook of Apple employees to help build their metaverse. They're also having their stringent return to work policy kicking into place over the next several weeks. So Apple wants to do everything it can to really retain that key talent. So they're giving these massive bonuses to people working in their self-driving car division, software engineering, and hardware engineering. And those four-year vesting periods are designed to keep those people in place for the next little while.
Now, Apple is, certainly one of those places that has always been a magnet for top talent, and they've managed to keep people for years, despite all of this competition. Is Apple facing, a bigger challenge with other big tech companies at this moment because of the post-pandemic environment?
I think every tech company is facing the same issue, right? You have people leaving Google. You have people leaving Microsoft, Amazon, Apple. You have people leaving all of these companies, right? So they're all competing with different benefits to keep their top talent. Interestingly, Apple is the place that you go to maybe if you're, you know, a veteran in your field, right? If you're the type of person who wants to work on a product that you know is going to be used by hundreds of millions or billions of people. That's not necessarily the same perk that you get by working at maybe Meta or Google or Facebook if we're talking about hardware or one unified service. So it is pretty enticing, you know, for certain people to work at Apple. Now, Apple doesn't always pay as much as competing companies, right? I know Meta, you know, is paying more than Apple for a number of very similar positions if you compare it apples to apples, right? Meta also has their, you know, remote work policy in place. So you could work at Meta, you can work remotely for as long as you want, whereas Apple, for 3 days per week, you're expected in the office. Likewise with Google, you'd be expected in the office 3 days per week. So everyone is competing for top talent in order to keep churning out these products.
All right. Well, we'll see how that shakes out, apples to apples, as you say. Mark Gurman, as always, thank you. Meantime, grocery delivery upstart Instacart has slashed its valuation by almost 40% to reflect public market declines across the tech industry. The company raised money at a $39 billion valuation last year. The new valuation, $24 billion. But the company believes the new number will give new employees more upside. I want to bring in Bloomberg's Jackie Davalos now for more details on this, another Bloomberg scoop. So Jackie, Instacart is voluntarily lowering its valuation. This is fairly unprecedented. But of course, if you look at companies like DoorDash, where we've seen massive declines, Shopify, where we see massive declines, they say this just makes sense. Give us some more context on why they're doing this.
You put it perfectly. This is not that unusual for perhaps a public company that is already, you know, has employees' eyes on their share price. What Instacart is doing is behaving more like a public company. There's been so much speculation that they could potentially IPO this year. But when you look at what's going on in the public markets, they took a step back and said that there is a bigger issue at play here outside of going public, which is the war for tech talent. Exactly what's going on in other companies around Silicon Valley. And so what's happening here now is that they're going to prioritize these recruitment efforts, new hires, entice them in by giving them shares at a lower price and then unlocking that upside as the company continues to grow.
Now, as I understand it, Instacart CEO Fidji Simo explained some of their reasoning at an all-hands meeting at the company today. Instacart also released this statement to us saying, we're confident in the strength of our business, but we're not immune to the market turbulence that has impacted leading technology companies, both public and private. We can't control the market, but we can control how we respond. How do you think employees, Jackie, are going to respond to this? I mean, it is one thing if you come into a company at a $39 billion valuation, and it's a different thing when you find out the next day it's worth $24 billion instead.
It's a delicate balance, and they are taking a look at what it's going to take to get to the next level, to achieve that next phase of growth, and they will need the people to get there. And so absolutely, for those longtime employees, for even the employees of Caper, as you recall, they acquired a company for stock earlier in October. Those employees will now only, you know, see a cut of about 40% less from where the purchase price was. So there are going to be winners and losers, but this is about the long-term play. And here Instacart is saying, we want to be a real player in this search for talent. And I think they're going to accomplish it, but you also have to think about what this means for investors. They came in at a $39 billion valuation. This time around last year, they poured in $265 million. Heavyweights like Andreessen Horowitz, Sequoia. So there are going to be those that don't benefit from this type of move. But overall, the long-term play is they're going to have the talent to really take them to the next level.
All right. Well, our very own Brad Stone is going to be sitting down with Instacart CEO Fidji Simo at Shop Talk next week. I'm sure this will be on the top of his agenda to talk to her about. So we'll be looking for highlights from that conversation. Jackie Davalos, who covers Instacart for us, thank you. Coming up, NVIDIA eyeing a deal with one of the biggest rivals it has, and that is Intel. How the competitors could be looking to collaborate to end the chip crisis. That is next. This is Bloomberg.
After returning to making computer monitors, Apple should now go back to another market, home Wi-Fi routers. 5 years ago, Apple's Mac business was a mess. The MacBook Pro had dropped key features, the Mac Pro was a disaster, and updates to the MacBook Air and Mac Mini were nowhere to be found. Apple had even stopped making routers and monitors. The story today could not be more different. Macs now have a fair blend of performance, battery life, and aesthetics, and Apple external monitors are back on sale. Next up should be those routers. Turn back the clock to 1999, and Apple was one of the first major proponents of Wi-Fi, launching an airport base station accessory that let users plug in an Ethernet cable to give their entire home wireless internet. Over time, Apple launched several new variations, like the high-end AirPort Extreme, a low-end AirPort Express, and the Time Capsule for wirelessly backing up Mac data. But then, in 2018, Apple discontinued its routers without giving any real explanation, ceding the market to competitors like Aero and others. Apple should now return to making privacy-focused, well-designed, and well-integrated routers for its own product hardware ecosystem. That router, of course, should be mesh, so it should include multiple pieces to expand wireless internet reliably across an entire home. Apple could even jam those routers into a HomePod Mini, taking a page out of Nest's book and creating a product that competes nicely with both the Google and Amazon ecosystems. I'm Mark Gurman. This is Power On.
You can subscribe to Mark's weekly Power On newsletter at Bloomberg.com. Now let's get an update on the world of chips with NVIDIA. One of the world's biggest chip makers said earlier this week it is considering tapping its main rival, Intel, to manufacture those chips. Let's get more on this with our very own Ian King, who of course covers the chip industry for us. Why would NVIDIA, Ian, decide to use Intel as its foundry?
Yeah, I mean, it's important to put these remarks in context. Kind of typical piece of Jensen Huang, the CEO, kind of talking really. He said, look, we're open to looking at any new suppliers. Having as many suppliers as we can possibly get makes sense. Intel, if you know, if they can get back to leading edge, if they can get back to, you know, the best production, best performance, then we'll definitely look at them.
So what's the next step here? What's going to get Intel over the line? Or NVIDIA, yeah, I mean, over the line?
Yeah, I mean, the other side of the Jensen Huang experience is he makes positive complimentary remarks about Intel, says this is the right thing for Intel to do, and then says, oh, by the way, yeah, getting to be as good as TSMC is going to be really difficult. They'll have to change their whole culture, and he starts on this long list of comparisons, unfavorable comparisons with TSMC and Samsung, and says how good they are. So the bottom line is he said it'll take a long time.
Now, yesterday, we/you also broke some news about the ARM IPO and looking at a $60 billion valuation. This, of course, that deal that NVIDIA couldn't close. $60 billion seems high, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, if you compare it to what the semiconductor sort of average multiples would give you, it's 10, 20 billion dollars above what even the highest end would be. But if you look at it from the price of what the NVIDIA transaction had become, given the appreciation of NVIDIA shares, it's about on par with what NVIDIA would have ended up paying for ARM. And what we're being told is that this is really just trying to set a floor in people's minds about what really SoftBank thinks this company is worth, because there's, as Masayoshi Son has said, this is a really pervasive company. This company is everywhere. It's way more than just another chip company.
And this ARM IPO is way more than just a traditional IPO, right? It's kind of complicated.
That's right. I mean, there's obviously a lot at stake. There's obviously one of the most important companies in the semiconductor industry, what will be the largest IPO in the sector by a long way. And at the same time, SoftBank, as we said in the story, is tapping these banks and saying, oh yes, if you want to underwrite this IPO, then you're going to have to basically loan us some money. You know, it's attaching multiple billions of dollars of margin loans to the mandate, which again is an interesting way to do things, and obviously has, you know, potentially positive consequences for SoftBank's liquidity.
All right, Ian King, thank you for those updates and all the news this week. Coming up, why everyone seems to be searching for EVs on Google this month. Could the war on Ukraine and rising gas prices be an inflection point for the world's transition to electric cars? We'll have more on that next. Plus, advice for startups in uncertain times as the war on Ukraine and inflation rattle markets worldwide. This is Bloomberg. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. I want to talk about what's going viral now. As gas prices surged at the pump this month, swarms of people took to Google to search all things EV. Top of the pile of questions, how much does it cost to charge an electric car? Searches for that phrase were up 400% this month, according to Google Trends. Our Ed Ludlow is here with why. And Ed, we've all felt that pain at the pump, and it hurts. Could all this searching be the beginning of a big transition, a big momentum shift for EVs?
Yeah, it's what everyone's been talking about, right? Now is a good time to own an EV. You look at the relative cost of running a car on gas versus running it on electricity, and the gap has just got wider in terms of cost of ownership. Plugging in and charging has been more cost effective. So we've seen it. People take to Google. There's other third-party data out there through online auctions, for example, secondhand car websites. They're thinking, where can I get an EV as soon as possible?
Celebrities are also jumping in on the fun here. There was a tweet from Ice-T that got Ice-T a lot of attention. Ice-T.
So he makes this joke, right, that he's at the gas station and he's been robbed. He says, I've been robbed. And he has this kind of long diatribe through the tweet. Get to the end of the tweet and you realize he's talking literally, of course, about the price of gas. Not that he's literally been physically robbed while filling up his car.
Right. Pump number 9, I believe, was the culprit. I think it's got like a million likes. Then there was Elon Musk dancing in Europe. How do we know this has to do with gas prices and not just enjoying Elon's dancing moves?
There's that tweet. This is the other point, right, that there are all these people that have decided because things are so bad at the gas pump, they're talking about it, they're venting on Twitter that they want an EV. And Elon Musk was dancing in Berlin because they're opening up a new factory, right? They're going to slowly ramp up production there. But the picture, look how happy he is. But the pictures speak to a much bigger point. There's all this potential in the world right now. The Austin plant in Texas, other EV makers coming online. I know, it's ridiculous, isn't it? But the point is that those things are exciting. They're not here right now. And it's really hard to get hold of an electric vehicle. If you go on Tesla's website and try buy one that's being built in Fremont or in Europe, the wait times are so long. So yeah, things are really tough right now at the gas pump. There's lots of excitement from Musk & Co. about the future for EVs. But getting your hands on one, it's really difficult.
Does Elon have moves, Ed? What do you think?
I declined to answer that one, Em.
The pawing of the drone, that was the best. All right, Ed, thank you. Well, with the war on Ukraine still raging, along with inflation, investors and companies around the world are reassessing. How long will it last? What's the path forward? Let's talk about all this and more with Mercedes Bent of Lightspeed Ventures. Mercedes, how are you assessing what impact this is going to have? Obviously, we're seeing what's happening to public markets, but what about private markets?
Thanks so much for having me, Emily. And I would say for the private markets, we've been noticing that the later stage is being affected a lot. A lot of the crossover hedge funds had come into the market, and now their core is really diving down quite a bit. And so that's meant that people are being much more wary of late stage rounds. When you look at the comparables also for the late stage rounds, you know, private companies might be raising at 10x or 100x revenues multiples, but then you see that same company with a very similar business model in the public markets is trading at 3 to 6x. And so then you ask yourself, well, what's really the possibility for this company if it was to go public anytime soon? Should I be paying this high of a multiple? So that's happening on the growth side. But then on the early stage side, we are seeing a lot of activity that doesn't seem entirely affected yet. So when I say early stage, I'm talking about seed, A, those rounds. And that has still been kind of business as usual.
We just saw Instacart slash its valuation by 40% from $39 to $24 billion. What do you make of that? And are we going to see more companies doing this?
I think we're going to continue to see more companies who are having to reassess what the dollar value, what the revenue is worth, and think through whether or not the prospects for the next 12 months are the same. We certainly are thinking about it across our entire portfolio and being much more cautious about our kind of growth stage valuations.
Meantime, we were speaking earlier with the chief economist at Citi talking about inflation, Andrew Hollenhorst. Take a listen to what he had to say.
This is not 4% inflation. This is not 5% inflation. This is inflation that's around 8% and set to pick up closer to 9%. In the next monthly reading on a year-on-year basis. And so that's why there's been such a change in expectations for what the Fed will do. This is really a Fed now that is in inflation fighting mode. And when you're in inflation fighting mode, you need to get rates to a level that actually provides some restraint on the economy.
Mercedes, this is going to impact companies on all fronts. How are you telling them to manage this?
We are certainly telling our companies at the early stage to, you know, think about how they're building their models in a much more sustainable way. We might be entering the bear market. We might be entering the period where capital is not going to be as accessible. And so they really need to have a plan for how they're going to support themselves with the funding they have and also rely on insider funding for the next 18 to 24 months. We also have a number of businesses that are affected from a supply chain perspective. And so we've been working with them over the last few really quarters and years. Because this isn't just the most recent phenomenon, but it's been going on during all of COVID. We've been working with them on alternative supply chain routes and ensuring that, you know, they are even getting their demand forecasted further and further ahead so that they don't have to be as reactive to short-term supply chain fluctuations.
All right, Mercedes-Benz, Lightspeed Ventures partner, thank you for giving us your perspective on all of this. Coming up, volatility, also still the name of the game in crypto. We're going to talk about it all with Aya Kantorovich of Falcon X. Our crypto segment is next. This is Bloomberg. Crypto report now as Ethereum is rising for another day, outperforming Bitcoin for a second week. Let's talk about it all with our crypto contributor, Shanali Bosick. Shanali, what's giving Ethereum a boost?
It's really interesting to look at, but we should first look at Bitcoin here, Emily, because with a 15% rise in Bitcoin over 2 weeks, it is over $44,000. It's really over $44,400 here. Significant lift in the last couple of days. But to your point, you are right. It is not rising as fast as Ethereum has been rising over the last two-week period, where you see a more than 20% rise in the price over the two-week period. People seem to be getting very excited here about the merge, the move to proof of stake concept. But it will be interesting. Remember, Ethereum has a lower base to rise off of, so the percentage rises are easier to see over there. The market cap is still a very wide between the two cryptocurrencies. So let's see what investors prefer.
Still a long way for Ethereum to go. Okay, Shanali, stay with us. We're going to be talking about this and more with our next guest, Aya Kantorovich, head of institutional coverage at Falcon X. Aya, what do you make of Ethereum's latest run? Does it have to do with the merge or something more?
Absolutely. Shanali hit the nail on the head. I think right now we're seeing two things in the market. The first is with the bullish activity around Bitcoin, possibly fueled by the news that Terra was planning on purchasing roughly $3 billion worth of Bitcoin for their treasury. And then seeing a lot of hedge funds and retail investors and aggregators taking profit share off of Bitcoin and transferring that into ETH and altcoins, as Shanali mentioned, into that ETH 2.0 merge and the excitement around that.
Well, two questions are for you. What more heat do you have behind ETH when you see some of the money already moving over? And what more room do more altcoins like Terra have to run here with that excitement that other funds have behind it?
So a lot of it has to do with the growth of the applications that are being built on top of these layer ones. So whether it's Ethereum or you're seeing that price activity also happening on top of layer ones like Avalanche this week, and a lot of that interoperability happening with bridging Bitcoin into these different layer ones and being able to use that store value asset as collateral for usage on those platforms, in addition just to overall more protocols and projects working on the travel rule and tackling that in order to make DeFi more accessible. All of these are very exciting for the application of these layer ones.
Meantime, Aya, we're still seeing Bitcoin trade within this fairly narrow range, and it's been happening now going on 2 months. Why is that, given all of the activity?
A lot of it has to do with the fact that Bitcoin is now adopted by institutions. And so we're seeing that volatility drop, which really means the mass adoption, both with what we're seeing across the desk in the conversations we're having with institutions across the board. And you're starting to see Bitcoin trade very similar to some of the assets in traditional finance. And so in general, there's more liquidity in the markets. And you're seeing Bitcoin and the price of Bitcoin being driven by institutions as opposed to crypto native volatility traders.
It's still gotten a good lift here over the last couple of weeks. It has really proven itself in some ways, but what is really going to give Bitcoin another leg here and make more institutions comfortable with the cryptocurrency?
So, you know, there are a number of institutions still going through due diligence with applying Bitcoin, whether it's onto their balance sheet or into their investment thesis. So we still don't have 100% of institutions in crypto. And so we're starting to and continuing to see that trickle roll into the space as institutions are looking for a store value asset and also just for returns across their portfolio in market as today.
Meantime, Falcon X has some pretty big ambitions to get the next 1 billion crypto users on board. Reports that you've earmarked $150 million for acquisitions globally. Talk to us about your expansion plans.
So we're really excited about the talent that we've brought on to our executive team. Very excited about Susie Walters, Sujay Jalati, and John Kaplan coming to us from Bloomberg, Carta, Ripple, and Pinterest, and having that caliber of talent joining us with a vision of a tokenized future.
You know, you mentioned before about this preference for some funds to get into Ether. I'm wondering, as you talk to all of these institutions, as you grow, how much is energy consumption a topic as you go along?
ESG is very much top of mind. And so to the earlier point that you mentioned, this transition from proof of work to proof of stake is going to be very, very important to the adoption that institutions view for Ethereum.
Watching the war on Ukraine as it plays out. Obviously, we've seen Bitcoin be used for humanitarian efforts. We've seen this executive order from President Biden, but there are also these remaining concerns about Russians specifically using cryptocurrency for illicit things to circumvent sanctions, for example. How does all of this continue to play out?
Specific to Ukraine, what we've seen in the effort to support Ukraine, whether it's within Ukraine itself, be it DAOs or NFT projects or more global Ukrainian projects, it's really just the validation that cryptocurrency is adopted and the interest is widespread. We're seeing that real-time value in action across this currency system. And more broadly, you know, very in terms of how it looks for all of the players in the ecosystem, we're continuing business as usual with the continued KYC AML that we have across the board, which is also super important about the underlying blockchain and its ability to be traceable and trackable.
And there's this question going on also about, you know, whether Bitcoin can really replace traditional currencies, what function it has for example, Ukrainians who are using it to convert their money or to raise money via NFTs or Ethereum or otherwise. When you're talking to institutions as well, do they see it becoming a replacement over some period of time?
That's a great question. I would say today institutions aren't viewing these major cryptocurrency assets as replacements, more so as something that goes alongside. More really where the focus is around stable coins and that widespread adoption and the way it's being adopted overall across all of the institutions using it today.
Aya Kantorovich, Falcon X, always great to have you here. Thank you, along with Bloomberg's Shanali Basak. All right, coming up, the space race of the 21st century. Russia remains a key leader in numerous space technologies. But with the war on Ukraine, a new era may be taking flight. That is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The war in Ukraine isn't just changing the game in cyberspace, but outer space as well. Satellite companies that relied on Russia's Soyuz rocket to get to orbit are now looking for a new ride amid sanctions and Russia cutting off access. U.S. launch providers like Northrop and ULA use Russian-built ROD-180 engines. Now Russia's Roscosmos is facing competition, not just from the likes of SpaceX, but also startups focused on building rocket engines. One of those startups is Ursa Major, whose founder and CEO, Joe Laurienti, joins us now alongside our very own Ed Ludlow. Joe, thank you so much for joining us. So I'd love for you to set the stage here. What's happening in outer space since the war on Ukraine started? We're seeing some big shifts in the sort of center of gravity, if you will, for space technologies.
Yeah, you touched on two of the big headlines. There's the lack of launch from Soyuz for Western players, famously in the last couple of weeks. OneWeb, a UK-based company, has been forced to buy launches from a competitor in SpaceX that has their own internet constellation. So that's one big piece of the story. And the second is the embargo on Russian rocket engine, in which Russia announced that they will no longer be selling here to the U.S. So I think the most common question I get on that piece of news is the U.S. was buying Russian rocket engines. I think that one always surprises folks.
Yeah, it is a bit of a surprise, isn't it, given the political tensions. And, you know, I think folks forget that before SpaceX, there wasn't a lot of option out there, right, Joe? So this must be pretty good news for you and your company. Right. Is your phone ringing quite a lot to ask about the readiness of your rocket engines?
It is. Yeah, obviously the international piece of this has been extremely busy. The U.S. government has been extremely busy, and then the commercial side is extremely impacted here as well. SpaceX obviously is doing a tremendous job filling their manifest with satellite operators, but the entire world has gone from a position of, is the launch market oversaturated, to why is OneWeb buying launches from a competitor? So I think that we're going to continue to stay really busy. And luckily, it's just shining a light on the propulsion industrial base globally and how companies like Ursa Major can come to help out both commercial entrants and the U.S. government.
So talk to us about that. How is Ursa Major different from SpaceX or Blue Origin or what the Russians have to offer?
Well, we're different from the Russians in that we're entirely domestic. So we can provide rocket engines here to the U.S. government and to U.S. players and Western players as it suits them. But as far as our business model and how we differentiate ourselves from a SpaceX or a Blue Origin, we are entirely propulsion focused. So our engines are designed to meet a wide range of needs from space launch on orbit to hypersonic testing in the case of some of our customers. So there's a technological advantage there in which the engines are designed for a wide range of applications and pretty diverse capability. But there's also an economic side of it in which we have a production line that we just got rolling this year. So there are some economies of scale for us delivering the same type of engine to multiple customers or multiple applications.
Hey, Joe, let's talk about that production line. I actually was listening to Elon Musk in Texas recently talk about how SpaceX is building one Raptor engine a day almost. But of course, SpaceX doesn't sell their Raptor engines to anyone else. What kind of pace of production have you guys got? And how quickly and how do you build these things? 3D printing, right?
Yeah, one a day is a tremendous pace. So we just started production in January of this year, and we hope to be delivering 30 engines to customers by the end of this year. But the focus is really shifting us from a capacity perspective of how many engines per year to a rate. Much like Elon said, an engine a day. We'd like to be at two engines a week here in the not-too-distant future. So the ramping there is really limited by how quickly we can assemble the engines. You touched on the 3D printing piece. Almost every part of these engines that is a primary component or a metallic component is 3D printed. We then hand assemble them here in Colorado and test them about 100 yards from where they are assembled. So I'm sitting not too far from where we fire our rocket engines.
Joe, there's another part of this story, and that is hypersonic weapons. The U.S. has confirmed that Russia has used hypersonic weapons against Ukraine, but the U.S. is behind not just Russia, but also China in hypersonic weapons, and the government is calling on companies like you to help change this. Talk to us about why this is important.
Yeah, that's the other side of the coin of the story here. We just saw Russia claim that they'd used the first hypersonic weapon in warfare. So the U.S. has been developing hypersonic capabilities for many years now. But what we've seen over the last couple of years is a resurgence of focus on flight testing hypersonics. So our engines are unique in that they are capable of being used on a number of applications, number of different vehicles, and they're capable of things like deep throttle or multiple restarts. So we can simulate flight across a pretty wide range of missions, and that's really important for this next phase of development because the U.S. will be forced to develop not just new hypersonic vehicles, but new technology and new capabilities, and that flight testing is an enormous component.
Hey, Joe, we only got a few seconds. How much money are you guys going to make this year?
It's hard to say yet. The year is definitely early, but we were excited to see a pretty heavy focus from the DoD budget that was just recently approved on hypersonic testing and spaceflight. So some nice tailwinds for us.
All right. Fascinating stuff, what you're doing and what's happening out there in outer space. Ursa Major, founder and CEO Joe Laurienti, and Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow. Thank you both. That does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Join us next week for a conversation. Our very own Brad Stone will be sitting down with Instacart CEO Fidji Simo at the Shop Talk Conference in Las Vegas, along with DoorDash President Christopher Payne. Also next week, I'll be speaking with Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi. We'll be joining you live from Shop Talk. Don't forget to tune in for a lot of interesting conversations. I'm Emily Chang in San Francisco. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. And don't forget to check out our podcast. This is Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.